there was so much censorship in apartheid South Africa, which meant that the kind of films that people immediately had access to were not for white markets. They were for black audiences. So the fact that there's a large number of us who grew up on a staple diet of kung fu films and Indian mainstream cinema is quite important, because we weren't always watching big American cinema. Many of us were actually navigating multicultural frameworks of representation.
Hello and welcome to the CineDB podcast series about African film professionals, hosted by three film curators and critics, one Anglophone, one Francophone, and one Lusophone. This 18-episode podcast series features directors, producers, educators, curators, and critics who share their experiences and reflections around their work. I'm your host, Katharina Hedren, film curator and critic. And in this episode, I'm talking to South African filmmaker and scholar Jyoti Mistry. In this episode, Jyoti and I continue a conversation about identity, belonging, and creative expression that has been going on for years. Jyoti talks about the importance of play as a strategy, about freedom, and why she makes no distinction between her roles as a filmmaker and an educator. Renowned South African filmmaker Jyoti Mistry, professor of film at HDK Valand at Gothenburg University in Sweden, works in film as a mode of research and artistic practice. Her most recent work is a trilogy exploring race, gender, and sexuality through archival sources. When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a Black Man, Cause of Death, and the forthcoming Loving in Between. Thank you for joining us for this conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome, Jyoti. The reason I'm in awe of you, your sharp brain and wonderful films aside, is your playfulness that is so free and considered at the same time. Can you tell me how moving images became your playground and the arena for your serious sense of play?
Thank you, Katharina. I love that you use the word awe, because awe has such wonderful different iterations, awesome and awful. So I think one of the things I want to talk about before I get into sort of the filmmaking part of the playfulness is to say maybe a little bit about how I come to images. I think it is quite important to say that I grew up in apartheid South Africa. And the world felt very, very narrow in the context of the images, but also the lived experiences. So there were two things that allowed me to understand the world as being elsewhere, that the world was possible elsewhere. And the one had to do with cinema and the other had to do with books. And both of those things actually gave me the imagination that the world wasn't defined in the way that I was experiencing it through the apartheid state and through the kind of structures and the domain of what apartheid had given me. So I think I come to images really because it, in some ways, it represented or created a forum for incredible space of freedom, that the world was somewhere in another way. And the thing that's wonderful for me about thinking about images in relation to this idea of freedom is play. I think of play as kind of a strategy of two things. One, plays tactical, and two, plays political. And on the surface, the word play seems very superficial because adults think about it as something that children do. But I think the word play is actually much more powerful than that, because play, any form of play, is rule-bound and rule-driven, and it assumes a respect for the rules. And if you respect the rules, then you know how to break those rules and what the boundaries of those rules are. So I think for me, play is a strategy of survival. And it's a way in which to think about play as a space of experimentation and innovation. But it's a tactical way of surviving And it's a tactical way of also reimagining things within rules, because rules also make us feel safe and secure. Because if we understand the rules and we understand the play, then we understand also the structures in which we can move within certain things. So I think play became a strategy for me to work with inside film, but also work inside institutional structures, and a strategy for actually figuring out how do you be political without actually losing your audience into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how I think about play, yeah.
Two things, and maybe they are related, because I was going to ask when you talk about, I find that interesting, about knowing the rules and then breaking them and messing with them and play around with them. I was wondering about, and I think that is linked to what you said about audiences, does that require that we have agreed on the games, so to say, which game we are playing and which rules we are following, which is not necessarily the case. Do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think the way you're posing that question is quite interesting, because it assumes, yes, that are we all playing the same game, right? Mm. And at what point do the rules change so that the game is actually different, but at the same time it's recognizable? And I think the sensitivity of a question is important, because when I talk about the tactics of survival as a strategy of play, I'm thinking about the fact that cinema has many rules. We've inherited certain grammars and rules of cinema, but those rules have come from somewhere else. They've often come from particular kinds of cinema traditions, often from the West or quite Eurocentric. So if you're trying to find a language for yourself, it means that you have to also be cognizant of those traditions or those games, those rules, in order to then figure out how you're going to play with it. But I also have a wonderful sort of way in which I think about it, and that comes from the Brazilian tradition of capoeira. And I love the idea that actually for the colonizers, capoeira looked like a dance or sort of a frivolous gesture that sort of enslaved people did without thinking about it as the tactics of a martial art, because it looked like a dance form with drums and kind of, here the natives again, dancing and singing. That's because that's what the natives do. But to really think about it as a strategy, as a tactic, and its playfulness. Yeah. And that's what I mean about the politics and the tactics of play. So to introduce it back to the idea that your question is about around this, the centrality of cinema, it's about thinking about that kind of that historical analogy of cinema as a tactics of play, that you can actually move within a political and discursive framework and still use the rules of what appears to be one thing but is doing something else. So that's kind of what I mean about playfulness as tactics, playfulness as politics.
And that sounds also like that it was very quickly a link then between the freedom of not just the, because freedom can also come from escapism. So we move away from a space that is oppressive. But you seem to immediately have taken it in your hand and made it a tool to fight back, so to say, or resist or whatever, but a tool.
Yeah, I think the word tool is really, really important here. I think tool is wonderful, because if we only think about cinema or film language as escapism and entertainment, which I think it's wonderful that it does that too, so I never want to be misunderstood. But I do think also cinema is a tool. It's a way in which we've actually made certain kinds of power relations possible. So we understand what beautiful is because cinema made that. And we understand what entertaining is because cinema made those rules, those representations of what constitutes entertainment. So I like that actually film is a tool. It's just it's a mechanism. It's a medium for creating knowledge, for creating experiences. And the one is not discrete or distinct from the other. I think something is political and it can be entertaining. Yeah. Something is escapist, but also thought-provoking. Because I think for a long time, there's been this idea because of the way in which capitalism and market economies have defined films that art house cinema is meant to be something that other people can't access. But I want to come back again to my background with images. There was so much censorship in apartheid South Africa, which meant that the kind of films that people immediately had access to were not for white markets. They were for black audiences. So the fact that there's a large number of us black filmmakers who grew up on a staple diet of kung fu films and Indian mainstream cinema is quite important because we weren't always watching big American cinema. So I think there is something to be said about many of us were actually navigating multicultural frameworks of representation.
Mm. I like that reference to kung fu and Indian cinema because it also takes me to capoeira, actually, that you mentioned that agility. You mentioned the word creating knowledge or the concept of that. And I want to talk to you about your dual role as a filmmaker and an educator. And I want to do that especially since I know that you don't see it that way. So can you tell me about that, why and what your take actually is?
Yeah, I think I love always, I just want to say that, Katerina, that you really respect the fact that I've chosen a career in education and I make films. People often want to either speak to me as a filmmaker or speak to me as like, you teach, so what does it mean to teach? But I like the fact that you've always been interested and curious about this kind of enmeshing and what I call this entanglement. Because the entanglement is really important. I make films because I think about it as a vehicle to explore experience and knowledge. We all bring certain kinds of knowledges to the world, or at least we're trying to explore knowledge and experience. What does it mean to be Swedish living in South Africa with an Ethiopian background? What does it mean to be from a background of Indian descent, a third generation of Indian descent in South Africa, identifying as somebody black, but then living in Sweden? So these kind of porous identities mean that actually the way I think about my career or my practice, as I say, as a filmmaker and my practice as a pedagogue are totally related. So the experiments I do with films that I make are things I bring to the classroom. And the things I'm interested in the classroom, I bring to the films that I make. So if I'm trying to explore race, I make a film about black masculinity with a film like When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a Black Man. If I'm interested in femicide and the way in which femicide and the violence against women's bodies continue to plague not just Africa, but the world, then I'm thinking about that in the films I make, like with Cause of Death, but I'm also bringing it into the classroom as a way to say, how do we rethink representation of women's bodies in cinema? So I think of these things as very, very angled and enmeshed, that my research, my teaching, and my practice as a filmmaker don't divide me as a person. They kind of make me whole and they inform each other.
Mm. Does that mean that you have a sense of learning while teaching, so to say, that you bring in from wherever it is, hearing yourself reflect or getting feedback from students, for example? Does that affect your filmmaking?
I think what I'm beginning to understand more and more is I want to unlearn certain expectations I have of cinema. So we think about even like the very early Soviet cinema, where cinema was going to be this revolutionary, now here's that word again, tool, right, to emancipate the workers. Or we think about third cinema as this revolutionary shooting 24 frames a second. I think about it less in this kind of didactic way anymore. So I think the unlearning that happens for me with students in the classroom and relearning is also the humility to recognize that what images mean for me is very different from what images mean for them. So in a generation of young people who are making images in their pocket, in other words, devices like your phone, Snapchat, TikTok, are 30 seconds of image making at your disposal, means that actually your relationship to moving images is very different from this rarefied idea of cinema in a darkened space.
Hmm.
It means that cinema is outside of cinema, not expanded cinema in the way we understand expanded cinema, but it's more expansive because it can be everywhere and anywhere at any time.
Hmm.
So there's this idea that we have to think about image making in radically challenging, innovative ways in the classroom that go past thinking about cinema in this very rigid capitalist production sense, because I think it's a very narrow way of reproducing an idea of cinema.
So I wanted to ask you that. So then, what is cinema? Is it possible to even ask the question and get an answer?
Well, I think that's the thing that I'm asking myself. Like, what is cinema if the experience of sitting collectively in a darkened auditorium with 300 other people watching the screen, if that is becoming an increasingly more rarefied experience because everyone is on a streaming platform? Somebody disclosed quite publicly when they were doing a review for a film like The Last Duel, a huge Ridley Scott film, that they watched the film on their phone.
Mm.
And they were reviewing it, having watched it on their phone.
Yeah.
Huge cinematic projects now actually become sort of accessible on your phone in this very intimate way, in this very tiny way. And then everyone producing images in a very quick way on their phone, which means, yes, I do think cinema is something else. The idea of image sequences is about something else. I'm not sure I'm answering your question as to the what it is.
Mm.
But I think I'm inviting, and that's going back to the classroom again, I'm inviting students to tell me, they're the generation who are using Snapchat and TikTok and social media to proliferate ideas in 30-second increments,
mm.
which means they're in a position to define cinema.
Yeah, because I think my question was also, is it possible even to define it? And from what you're saying now, it also feels like cinema much more than a one-way communication device is now a platform for instant communication, instant exchange.
And interruption. I mean, that's the other thing that I really find quite fascinating is that you can interrupt a cinematic experience because you can meme it, you can pull it out, you can satirize it, you can ironize it, you can also kind of poke fun at it, you can mock it is the phrase I want. So I think that I would just be cautious to say I'm increasingly using in my own thinking just image sequences. So cinema is this particular thing that has quite a particular history of the darkened space, this collectivizing experience, the idea of the camera obscura. But then we in another mold where the image sequences we create in these very short bursts that interrupt cinema language are image sequences. They don't have to be these big cinematic grand gestures, but yet are as powerful because there is social media bullying and there is the way in which memes upset and destroy and antagonize people.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about it in this kind of expanded way of image making repertoire. If that makes sense at all, Katerina.
In the way you just described, you mean?
Yes, that it's more expansive. So to be narrow, to just think about cinema as this kind of buying your ticket and going on a hot date or going to a festival, I think is there. But I think the power of images are doing something else in many different contexts. So I think about it as expansive rather than the term expanded. It's everywhere.
I hear you.
But I think, so that's the play in the classroom for me. It's about, you are the generation who are dealing with this. How are you going to work with it? How are you going to define it?
Which is also Then again, when we talk about the filmmaker as an educator and an animator in a way, or mediator, which, because I'm obsessed with you and playing, but if we talk again about education, research, creativity, because they all go together somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the joy of the way you're posing the question means that it's an opportunity for me to show you that actually it's over a decade, Katerina, that I invited you to play with me.
It's true.
Maybe your interest in my play strategy has to do with the fact that I think the nice thing is that we got to play with each other, actually.
I think you're right.
So I brought something that I'd like to share with you. And it's from 2012.
Oh, wow.
When we were young puppies in a playpen together. I don't know if you can remember 2012.
Long time ago. I remember it vaguely.
Actually, it was 2010.
Yeah.
So it's actually 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And the film is Le Veuf sans le Toit. And I have a little piece from the film that I'd like to share with you.
Oh, please do. An elderly woman holds her bag a little bit tighter when I sit down next to her in the streetcar. The streetcar is cramped with people standing, but the seat next to me remains empty. A gob of spit lands on the window where I sit, courtesy of a blonde boy passing by. A stranger asks me if I miss my birth mother, if I experience racism, how often I go back home, and why not more often. I bite my tongue in secret and disgust, having once again forgotten that I owe explanations to no one.
So, Katerina, the wonderful thing about having this opportunity with you in 2010, and that's why I wanted to bring this as a reminder that we've had the experience of playing together, which was incredible, was you gave me a wonderful space to connect with your experiences of growing up as a young person with Ethiopian descent, but growing up in a Swedish environment. And the assumptions made about one race, but also language.
Mm.
And I loved the conversation that inspired this piece in my film about the way in which we navigate public spaces and how you also had tactics of surviving in Sweden because there were so many assumptions made about you not actually being Swedish.
Mm.
So I really appreciate your returning to this idea of play because I think you've introduced something important. I've talked about play as tactical. I've talked about play as political. But I think in this piece, you capture something really brilliantly, which is play as a politics of survival.
Hmm.
It's a practice of survival.
Hmm.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because in some ways you've played with me thinking through that.
Yeah, thank you for that throwback. It's lovely and very well picked. Because I think that it also emphasized one aspect, maybe the most important one, because I mentioned the word, I used the word considered, your considered play, and we talked about political and tactical and strategical and using it as a tool. And I think of the last part that I so brilliantly expressed in this spot where I say, I bite my tongue, having once again forgotten. And I think that that is also a crucial part of play. The mistakes, and you use the word practice, that a practice can never be perfect, that you have to bite your tongue, realize that you made a mistake, start all over, etc. And I really appreciate that part of it. And I'd actually like to hear your take on that, the imperfection and the doing it again and not succeeding, because success is such an important concept in filmmaking, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's key to what drives the filmmaker, right? Like whether an audience will get or understand, appreciate, empathize, escape, be entertained, be provoked, be educated, if any of those things are desires, aspirations of freedom. Yeah, there are two things, I guess, that you're cueing me to talk about. One is the idea of the fact that I've become more interested in seeing the practice of filmmaking. And second, like the practice of survival. Because I think those things are actually important in the way I'm thinking about sort of that opportunity when we got to work together on this film, as you sharing with me the practice of survival, that actually when you don't read the code correctly, you've experienced a kind of racism so that we know for the next time not to do something. Mm-hmm. And I love this idea that when you're in school also, and when you're making these kinds of smaller films, I'm going to say it in that way because I want to make sure that I'm not misunderstood. Like every film is where you can quote unquote fail. Because sometimes it's strategic not to fail. And I want to come back to that idea. Because sometimes the structures are set up for, say, a Black filmmaker or a woman filmmaker to fail. But that's a different kind of failure that has to do with a particular kind of structural sort of configuration of how access and privilege work. So that's a different conversation. But I think what I want to say about the wonderful idea of practice, and it's also, again, I'm inspired by the way in which jazz artists and musicians talk about their work. You keep practicing and doing it over and over again because you're leading towards this kind of moment when improvisation and practice becomes this kind of rapture, which I don't think we really have in film. And I've been thinking about that a long time, that there's some things that's quite particular to this medium that forces filmmaking to kind of feel locked in something. We even use a phrase like picture lock, sound lock. So practice in some ways, what happens if you revisit your film? What happens if you open up your own film? So I love this idea that actually if you're in a film practice, you're in this space of also doing it again and again in different ways in order to kind of reach some new understanding of not only what it is that you're doing, but also what you're experimenting with and what innovations you're trying to do. But I do want to be clear, this is the joy of actually being a filmmaker inside a teaching learning environment. And it's a different kind of calculated proposition of a practice if you're making a $60 million film and you're a Black person or you're a woman. And the odds and the structures are set up in such a way that you don't have that space for that particular kind of practice.
Yeah.
Or the luxury to call it a calculated failure.
Yes, that's true. And it's not cute when certain people do it.
No, absolutely not. So I think that, again, there's a caution, you know, we must be very circumspect when we speak about these things. Because when we're speaking from the South, or when we're speaking as women or as Black subjects, the cadence of failure has a very different currency from the way in which it's talked about in a Eurocentric or in an artistic research sense.
Yeah. Oh, that puts the strategy and the politic use of it in a very good context. There's a word that has been implied. I don't know if we said it out loud, the F word, F for freedom, that is implied in everything we've talked about. The notion of freedom to express, to create, explore, and express in whichever way one wants without expectations and assumptions based on factors that you just talked about, origin, gender, ethnicity, orientation. And if we put us in a space when the dream comes true, when filmmakers in or have been or in various degrees are being marginalized, when, let's say for the context of the pod, when African filmmakers then are free and unconstrained, what does that mean?
I think that's a very powerful question, but I would also say that I spent a lot of time thinking about this word freedom when I grew up, I want to be a black man, because it comes from the phrase, when I grow up, I want to be a black man, comes from a film made in 1956 in the German archive. And it's a little boy lying in bed, a little white boy lying in bed. And his mother says to him, "So when you grow up, what do you want to be?" And he replies in German, "When I grow up, I want to be a black man." And when I first saw this film, I was struck actually by the fact that in this moment in history, the aspiration to be a black man is about taking on a huge burden of violence, oppression, and the assumption that the aspiration could be a desire to be black, but also a black man, is really powerful, but also very, very, was kind of shocking for me. Is it an aspiration built out of naivety? Or is it an aspiration in recognition of a total freedom from race? So to answer your question, I think freedom is a very powerful thing because freedom also has implications. If I'm free, does it impinge on your rights? And if you are free, have you done something for that freedom that violates me? And so when I grow up, I want to be a black man is a diptych where the lexicon of violence is in conversation with the lexicon of freedom. And the humbling experience for me in making that project was recognizing that some of the language that we use to talk about freedom is exactly the same language that we use for violence, right? So land. Right, the audacity of going to another part of the world and just taking somebody's land is a radical act of imagination and freedom to assume that you can just take somebody's land, right?
Yeah.
So to come back to your question, which I think is a really poignant one, of what would freedom mean for African filmmakers on the continent, but even filmmakers, African filmmakers of African descent in the diaspora, I think is to emancipate our imagination from certain kind of historical issues, that we also relearn our history of oppression in a different way. And I think there's some amazing filmmakers who are doing that. There's a lot of work done around historical work of going back and looking at histories that haven't been told. And that's a freedom that we like go back into the archive, myself included, and try to figure out those stories that haven't been told, how do you tell those stories? But the freedom, I think, is really about an act of imagination that at this point, I think, is about how would we reconstitute the world where we come from without the corruption, without the femicide, without the stealing from each other? How do we create a social and political framework that honors our humanity again? Actually, I think that for me, for a filmmaker, would be the imaginative space that we want to create in the films we make. That there is a way that we can be where there isn't the obligatory chase sequence for 30 minutes. And I'm watching the film and going, wow, that chase sequence was $30 million. Two African filmmakers could make very good films with just that chase sequence. Because somebody had the freedom to blow up 16 cars. So that's freedom to blow up 16 cars and have an incredible chase sequence. That's one kind of artistic freedom, but it's at the cost of another kind of freedom that's taking away from something else. So I always think about freedom now in this kind of this dialectic. It's not a free-for-all because there's a scale in it somewhere.
I actually think that is the perfect way to end this beautiful conversation, with emphasizing again the dialectic and that it continues, that there is no answer and there is no either or, the non-duality of things. I want to thank you for a beautiful discussion, Jyoti.
I love that you said the non-duality of things. Thank you, Katerina. I always enjoy talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening, and thanks to Jyoti Mistry for sharing her vision of what cinema is and can be.
I highly recommend our series in French, hosted by film critic and curator Gia Mambo, and in Portuguese, hosted by scholar and curator Janaína Oliveira. You can subscribe to the CineDB podcast series in any of the three languages on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Lucky are those who speak all three languages, because you will get the maximum out of this series. This episode was created by Akinesthetic, with executive production and curation done by myself, Katerina Hedren. Podcast production is done by Vasti Kalitz, with help from Andre Burnett, who is also our editor. CineDB Africa is a project aimed at connecting African film professionals with one another and audiences. This series is funded by the GIZ, the German Agency for International Cooperation, and the Goethe Institute. Film critic and curator Gia Mambo, and in Portuguese,